Well, hello, 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 and welcome to Take 127 Overlooked. You all right, Mike? Mike's having a moment.
I didn't think we'd started. Sorry about that.
Turned into Iggy Pop.
I'll start again.
I want to be your dog.
Hello, and welcome to Take 127 Overlooked on Ship Full of Bombs, Thames
Ben.
Delta, Independent Radio, www.sfob.co.uk. Welcome to the show. Willkommen the show.
Welcome.
Let's do the usual.
We can start this again.
I don't think we need to. I think this is what the listeners tune in for.
Yeah.
In their many tens.
Okay.
Yeah. So yes. Anyway, welcome to the show. My name is Dan. I'll let you guys introduce yourself. Let's start with our engineer and knob twiddler first of all. Oof. Hello.
Oh dear.
Ian.
I'm unaccustomed to being top of the list, so yes, good evening, everybody. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for being here, Ian, the man who makes it all happen, who allows it to happen.
The magic.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Next.
Still ahead of Dan.
Yes.
It's Kirk. Hello, everyone.
Hello, Kirk.
Hello, listeners.
How are you? You all right?
I'm not too bad, thank you. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. You're looking very... summary there.
I feel
in your,
summary.
Sort of, you know, checked shirt, lumberjack style shirt.
Yeah.
Old hipster, you.
Yeah. With even a bit of a growth on the face as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Speaking of growth on the face, here's the growth on the face of this show.
Oh, thanks for that, Dan. Yeah, that's lovely, that is. I'm the man that makes magic stop.
How are you doing, Mike? Are you okay?
Not really, but I'll leave my problems aside.
Oh, okay.
No greater love.
Yeah.
It's all going swimmingly so far, though.
It's splendid. That's it. We're only 3 minutes in. It feels so much longer, doesn't it?
Oh dear, I need to have a drink already.
So, the theme. We have decided on a theme, haven't we?
Yes.
Mm. Or rather, the film gods, the old gods, decided a theme for us, because we kind of chose two movies and then we discovered afterwards there is quite a strong theme between them. And that theme is yuppie nightmares. Mm. And Mike discovered that theme, so thank you for that, Mike.
Yeah.
You're quite welcome.
Yuppie nightmares, yes.
Our younger listener wouldn't even know what a yuppie is.
No, they
wouldn't know.
No.
It's not a fish, listeners.
So what is a yuppie then? Come on, what does it stand for?
Young, upper, privileged, punts. I don't know. So something like that.
Essentially, I get the feeling that none of us can really remember.
I do remember young, upwardly mobile person.
But that would be yump.
But it's something along those lines.
Oh, okay.
Upwardly mobile's in there anyway.
Oh, okay.
I think I was closer.
Okay. Maybe. You know what? Let's just maybe talk about some films.
It's very 80s.
Yes, very much an 80s thing. And indeed, both of the movies we're going to be discussing today are from the 80s, which initially filled me with a little bit of horror, because I hold a personal view that the 80s was not a spectacular decade for movies, apart from the mainstream fare like your Gremlins and Back to the Future and stuff like that. But I'm kind of being turned around by Kirk, who is a bit of a cheerleader for the 80s, aren't you?
Yeah, I like the 80s. I think there were some hidden gems in there, and that's what this show's all about. So.
It is indeed very well said. Mm. We couldn't have scripted it better.
Yeah.
So, Kirk, with no further ado, we've got a slightly different way that we're doing it tonight, and we may do it this way forevermore, which is I'm not going to do the synopses anymore. There's one major reason for that, which is that I can't be bothered. And also because you folks at home are probably going to get sick and tired of the sound of my voice. So I'm going to pass on to Kirk. I'm going to go away in the corner here and have a swig of my beer. Kirk,
and have a
entertain
cigarette
us.
All right. Okay. So the first film we're going to talk about tonight is Something Wild, directed by Jonathan Demme, released in 1986. And I'll just go through the synopsis for you. Charlie Driggs is a seemingly conventional banker based in New York City, sitting in a diner having lunch. A Louise Brooks lookalike, who calls herself Lulu, spots Charlie leaving the diner without paying. Lulu confronts Charlie outside in a teasing manner. Lulu notices that Charlie has a rebellious streak, so Lulu invites Charlie to jump into her car that she has acquired from a divorce settlement and give him a lift. This leads to Charlie to go on a crazy and confusing road trip, which they both discover they have both been liking. I've got my word wrong there. Both been liking each other, and it takes off in a darker manner towards the end of the film. So I couldn't read my own writing there, so that's why I fumbled.
So it's essentially a bit of a road trip movie, isn't it?
Yeah, it is essentially.
So what should we do first? Should we talk about whether the film's any good or not, and then maybe delve into a little bit of the background of it and a few little snippets of interest to the more hardcore seasoned film enthusiasts amongst our audience? What do you think of it, Kirk?
Yeah.
After all, this was your suggestion, wasn't it?
It was my suggestion, and I hadn't seen it for quite a number of years, probably maybe getting on for nearly 20 years. And I do recall at the time probably really enjoying the film, partly because it was, I suppose it was my period in time. It had a really good soundtrack. Had Melanie Griffiths in it, and Jeff Daniels, some good actors at the time, and yeah, it was kind of an interesting film about like sort of middle America yuppies, as we've already mentioned, but also that kind of throwing caution to the wind kind of story where you know, something can a turn of events can change things just suddenly, just like that, and I think my views is it is a little bit dated, but I did enjoy it, and I did think it was an interesting story because it kind of, the way it's portrayed or the way all the presentation of the film is, it almost looks like it could be a comedy or that kind of a film. And to a degree, it kind of is, but then midway through, it does turn quite dark. And, you know, basically, there is an element where an ex-boyfriend comes in and he's like an ex-criminal and he's been inside. And he's a bit of a nasty character. And
played very well by Ray Liotta.
In his first ever role as well. So, So it's an interesting film because I don't know many films whereby the tone changes. Certainly not American films. I can think of French films where their tone changes halfway through, but certainly not many American films. So, and as we've mentioned, it was directed by Jonathan Demme,
who sadly, of course, at the time of recording, passed away not that long ago, didn't he?
That's right. Yeah, only about a month ago. Yeah. So very sad. And it was kind of like he'd already had quite an established career prior to Something Wild. But he'd had a bit of a difficult time with his film before, and it was a film with Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell called Swing Shift, and he was having trouble making that film, and he wanted to go in a particular tone, and ultimately Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn wanted it to go in a sort of funny route. So he was a bit despondent at the time, and he wasn't sure where his career was going. And this script sort of landed on his desk, and basically it was kind of like a reboot of his whole career.
So this was Jonathan Demme was going through a bit of a crisis himself, wondering whether or not he, you know, what was he doing in the film industry?
Yeah, exactly.
And then he made this film.
Yeah.
The reason I specifically mention that is because that will be, that is going to be an interesting link for later for the next film.
Indeed.
Yeah. It's exactly the same scenario as the next film, where you've got a director who was on the edge of sanity and just thinking, I'm not even sure if I want to make movies anymore.
Mm.
This is, you know, he'd had a horrible experience.
Yeah.
But we'll come back to that.
Yeah, so there are definitely parallels because, the film Jonathan Demme made after that Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell film was, of course, Stop Making Sense with Talking Heads. And then this was the first proper script, you know, non-documentary, if you like, script that landed on his doorstep, as it were. So... Yeah, so I think it's an interesting film. I wouldn't say it was a masterpiece or anything like that, but I would say, you know, if you want to look for a typical 80s period film, I'd say it would fit the bill quite well. I think it portrays that period very well. It captures that element. Mm. It's got an amazing soundtrack, which is actually a borrowed soundtrack because there's only one original piece of music in it, which is by Laurie Anderson and John Cale.
Mm.
The rest of it, so it's all like new wave bands, like New Order. I'm trying to think of some other bands in there off the top of my head. But yeah, it's all kind of borrowed soundtrack, which is kind of like what Quentin Tarantino did later on in the 90s, of course.
Yes.
So I found it intriguing. It was almost like an anthropological journey back into that period, almost, you know.
Speaking of soundtracks, this has got a very good soundtrack, hasn't it? You were able to get quite a few songs on your playlist, weren't you, Mike?
Yeah.
Shall we have one of them now? What do you think?
If like, yeah. Okay, let's go for... let's go for Wild Thing by Sister Carol.
Oh, marvellous. Okay, we'll get Ian to cue that up. Wild Thing, Sister Carol.
I remember when I was a little girl, our house caught on fire.
Apologies there.
That's a little clue for the
next
movie.
What was that? Yes. So what was that? That was... Have you missed...
What?
...titled these?
It could be king. You go your way and I go mine. As long as you just make it fine. Come rain and shine, some drinking wine. Some even dress like Frankenstein. Move up your waist, your body line. But just you do it right on time. Wild thing. Oh-oh. It is a wild thing. It is a wild thing. Come on, shake it. Wild thing. Those funky shoes you always wear. The things you got can't even share. Complaining that you're on welfare. Stay with the beat and move your feet. And do it till you feel the heat. Drinking wine, some even dress like Frankenstein. Move up your waist, your body line, but just you do it right on time. Wild thing, oh oh, it is a wild thing, Lord, it is a wild thing. Shake it, it is a wild thing.
All right, we are Wild Thing by
Sister Carol
King, Sister Carol. That's it.
Obviously a version of Wild Thing.
Yes, by...
By the Troggs.
Yes, well done.
Reg Presley.
Yes, yes, indeed. The King. I don't really know much about music.
But that's kind of indicative. I mean, we'll play more music, but it's very, very eclectic. And yes, hopefully we'll play a few more sonic delights.
Oh, marvellous. I will very quickly say, before I pass to you, Mike, that you said, Kirk, before we had that tune, if you can call it that, that you said that it had been quite a long time since you'd seen this movie and you really watched it, and bits of it hadn't worn well, but you still really enjoyed it. This was a first watch for me. I hadn't seen it before. And my concern with a lot of 80s movies is that there's a kind of a rose-tinted spectacles thing where people say, oh, this movie's fantastic, because they loved it when they were much younger. An example for me would be Goonies. Never saw the Goonies when it came out. I only watched Goonies for the first time about 5 or 6 years ago.
I saw it at the cinema last week.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, well. But yeah, I'd only seen it 5 or 6 years ago, and I really thought it was okay. I didn't think it was fantastic, but that's because it wasn't. I didn't catch it at the time, and it didn't become part of my childhood or anything like that. This movie, I worried that it would suffer from that I would watch it and it would be awfully dated. I wouldn't be able to connect with it. Not the case at all. Really enjoyed this. Very accessible. And it didn't feel that dated to me. So, yeah, definitely worth a look, I think. So, yeah, as a first-time watcher, anybody else out there who hasn't seen it, it is really worth a go, I would say that. I'm going to pass over now to Mike, because I'm intrigued, I say, to know what Mike's views are of this film.
Well, I saw this film when it first came out at the cinema, because I am that old. And I loved
it. Me too.
I loved it. But I kind of thought it was a guilty pleasure, because over the years I kind of thought it's probably not that good, but I love it anyway. And I saw it again quite recently, because it turned up on Netflix. So I thought, it's still pretty good. It's still pretty good. And then I saw it again for the show, and I'm back to my first opinion. I think it's a fantastic film. So I think, Kirk, I think you're damning it with faint praise. Yeah. I think it's fantastic. I don't think it's a masterpiece, but I think it's fantastic. It's just totally satisfying, I think. It's got a fantastic soundtrack. Absolutely
Fantastic,
yeah. career high performances from Jeff Daniels and Melanie Griffiths. Even Dumb and Dumber. That is a height of comedy. But I mean, I think it is a comedy. It's a black. It gets very black, but it is a definite comedy. It was quite saucy when it came out. There's a few saucy sex scenes in it.
Oh, yes.
Of a saucy variety.
Oh, you get your money's worth, don't you?
You do,
for this
don't
film.
You? Yeah. And she don't care, does she?
No, she doesn't.
She doesn't. She lets them swing around, doesn't she?
Oh, heavens.
Too much information.
Oh, yeah. Dear, oh dear.
You mean and the lights above?
And when I was a young lad of about 2 when I saw the film at the cinema, you know, that made quite an impression on me. And now as an old man of 21, it still does.
Yes, it puts a twinkle in your eye.
He certainly did, and it put a bit of zest in me. Anyway.
Can we please move on?
But I think it's a fantastically scripted film. I just think it zips along at a pace. There's loads to like. There's little cameos from people that I personally find quite entertaining. Like John Waters pops up as a sleazy car salesman.
That was a great cameo.
John Sayles, who's an alpha exploitation director, he turns up at one point as a motorcycle cop.
There's a couple of Jonathan Demme's kind of regulars as well in there. Charles Napier and Kenneth Utt. And I recognise both of those from The Silence of the Lambs.
Kenneth Utt is a producer. He's not an actor.
Really?
He's a producer. And he was... there's a scene, they go to a restaurant, Mum and Dad's, Mum and Pop's.
Pops, yeah, something like that, Italian restaurant. Yes.
So he's a producer too.
And Charles Napier is the head chef.
It's a brilliant little funny sequence. Mm. But I just like the way, much like the next film we're going to talk about, it starts off, it's in a coffee shop, and it starts off fairly innocuous, and it just escalates out of control, the plot, and it gets worse and worse for the main character. He's very reactive. He doesn't actually do very much apart from react. Towards the end, he sort of switches tables a bit. Mm. But at the start, and for half the movie, he's just going along with the flow. And it's wonderful.
I would also say that one of the main themes of the film is about lying or deceiving as well.
Yes.
Because both main characters deceive each other right from the off, in a way.
So
That's a really integral part of the plot. You know.
I've got to say, I found that to be a problem because I found it quite difficult to identify or sympathise with either of them.
Mm.
Because, and here's an issue, I don't know what how much of this is going to be kind of spoiler territory, but I felt certainly with him that I couldn't sympathise with him because you shouldn't be doing what you're doing.
Mm.
You really shouldn't be doing this. And it's only later in the film that you kind of find out,
there's a bit of a reveal.
There's a reveal at which point I became a little bit more sympathetic with him and then strangely less sympathetic with her.
Mm.
So it's weird. I found that I didn't get to the end of the film thinking, oh, I hope that they get together. Mm. I hope they fall in love. I didn't think that at all because for half of the film, I hadn't really liked him, and the other half, I hadn't liked her.
Yeah.
So that's, I would say, that's a little bit of an issue with it.
They're definitely flawed characters. You know, there's
very
nothing.
Much so.
You know, if you met them in real life, you probably wouldn't like them that much. You know,
apart from Melanie Griffith, of course.
Mike certainly got a special point about Melanie. Yes,
absolutely. And by the way, I've got to say that for a big chunk of the first bit of the film, she's got what did you say? Her hair, it's black.
Bobbed.
And what is it? Who's she meant to be?
Well, there's a reference that she looks a bit like the silent movie star Louise Brooks. So, it's that kind of bobbed, angular haircut.
And her name is Lulu, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. She calls herself Lulu.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic, and she looks so attractive, and it's almost a timeless look.
Mm.
And then later on in the film, she gets her hair done and kind of like blonded up and spiked up and short, which obviously was appropriate at the time, but then really badly dates it. and I kind of wish that she would dig the wig out again and put that on because she looked so much better.
Yeah.
Anyway, I digress. That's of no value whatsoever and doesn't propel the conversation forwards in a positive way.
Funny, she kept her clothes on with the blonde wig.
She did, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because I noticed, I got my scorecard out. And
Oh, is that, is that what you call it?
Yeah.
That's one.
just a quick bit of triv.
Yes, please.
I must
please
mention to get Mike off of the whole. The messy.
He's looking
subject.
A bit flustered.
There was very interesting that the cinematographer on this was a Japanese American called Tak Fujimoto, and he worked on Silence of the Lambs. I mean, he was quite a regular with Jonathan Demme, but interestingly, he also worked on Ferris Bueller's Day Off as well.
Oh, okay.
And there's a particular shot in the film that he uses. It's almost like a trademark, whereby he zooms into a face at close angle, and it's like a symmetrical shot, and you see that in all of the films that he's worked on. So I thought it was very interesting. There was it's a bit of a spoiler for this film, but I won't mention the scene. But there is a scene with Ray Liotta where it's a really close up shot, and it's a very good shot as well. I mean, it's a really good moment in the film, so it's worth sort of mentioning that.
Because we haven't spoken much about Ray Liotta, have we?
I think we should.
And
because this performance is in one performance, Ray Liotta has discovered the Ray Liotta thin Ray cliche of over the top chewing scenery performance.
Yeah.
And it is like perfected in one film. There was nothing to suggest he was going to be just that, and he played the same part many, many films afterwards.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
And then, like, Goodfellas is pretty much just a version of the Ray in this film.
Mm. Kind of, ish. Yeah. The Henry Hill character in Goodfellas evolves into a the Ray kind of character. Mm. What I thought was closer was... what's the one that he was in? It's not. It's not Training Day. It's Narc.
Oh no!
Narc.
Yeah.
I could see echoes of his performance in Narc in this. Mm. But yeah,
and also Hannibal as well. A little bit. There was an element of that.
Yes, actually. Yeah. Now you mention it. Yeah. Of course.
Which is another link.
Yes, absolutely. Of course.
Hannibal Lecter link there.
Yes. Yeah. But so. We're all agreed, aren't we, I think, that this is definitely worth seeing. I think you probably summed it up well, Mike, when you said it's not a masterpiece, but is it a hidden gem?
Yeah. It's only hidden because I don't think it's got the respect it deserves. I mean, Demme's won 2 Oscars for Best Feature, back-to-back Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't consecutive years, but the films are back-to-back.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Silence of the Lambs of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And this was before them, and it's kind of got lost in the shuffle, really. Yeah. It's not really... it's part of his canon.
Are we back to Melanie Griffith again? I'm sorry. I apologise for that cheap shot.
Brought it down again.
Well, that's beneath you, that is. That's...
I'm sorry. I amused myself.
But I personally think it's better than Philadelphia or Silence of the Lambs.
Hmm.
All of them good films. Hmm. For me, this is possibly his best film.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, I would say so.
Oh, okay.
In my opinion.
Wow.
Which is the one that counts, obviously.
Well, yes, obviously, naturally.
Yeah.
It is a hidden gem. However, it has got some recognition, hasn't it? Because in terms of availability, it's fairly widely available on DVD.
Yeah.
Mm. It hasn't had a Blu-ray release in this country, but Kirk, you'll be the expert on this because you have this.
It has got a Criterion release in the USA.
Absolutely,
so
on Blu-ray.
Lot.
So, yes.
And
it's one that you have, isn't it?
It is one that I have. I actually purchased it. Yeah.
You did. And extras any good?
The extras actually quite minimal. There was 2 new interviews, one with Jonathan Demme and another with the scriptwriter. And they were quite extensive interviews. They were probably 40 minutes each. So and that was it. There was no director's commentary or anything. So quite minimal for Criterion, actually.
Yeah.
But I have to say the transfer was fantastic.
Oh,
absolutely beautiful looking film. Really just amazing. Yeah.
So worth getting if you can pony up the 25 quid or whatever it is to buy. I will just say the writer, E. Max Frey, who also wrote and directed Amos and Andrew. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. Where the Money Is, which was a Paul Newman movie. And most recently, Foxcatcher.
Really?
Which was very good indeed. Yeah. Very much enjoyed that.
And also, there's a link to him with the next film as well. Because he was thinking of considering the next director of the next film for doing this movie, for doing something wild.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
But he wasn't available at that time.
And
with Demme.
Right, so the person that directed the next movie we're going to talk about was in consideration for directing something wild.
Yeah.
Well, I did not know that.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's a
thank
good bit
you,
of trivia.
Kirk,
thank you for
educating and enlightening.
Indeed. Yes, that's easy for you to say. Right, shall we have another bit of music, Mike?
Yes, please.
What bit of music is this?
Well, funny enough, this is another piece of music from something... Well, it's not that funny, because that's what we're talking about. Yes. That's not so funny.
Predictably, it's from something...
Yeah,
wild.
And I'd go for the... It's funny of music used in one of the sex scenes.
Oh, dear.
Oh.
And it's by...
I'm leaving the room.
It's by The Fabulous Five, and it's called Ooh Ah.
Right now, you see, I... Ooh, what? Go ahead and study. Ooh, what? Ooh,
watch ya now. Sure. I just chew. Shake. Chew. Ooh. Wah. I just run it. You know, see. Just through the vibe, them I work a certain way. Ire.
Ire.
Just go, I wanna penetrate to another one like, oh. Ooh. Wah. Going out differently started. Go, 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 go. Ooh, wow. Ooh, wow. Ooh, wow. Go. Ooh, wow. So, I want them things. So they have them sight up why I'm gonna deal with sin.
Sin.
Well, here you know. Watch you know. Get this now. Right now, I'm gonna look at us in a sin. So I'm gonna go both sin.
Sin.
Little more here. Yeah? More time I'm on the island reason again. Sin.
Sin.
Go in and start it. Go, 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 go. Go.
Put it away, mate. Put it away. Nobody wants to see that. Yes, so right, are you ready? Are you decent?
Don't know. Can you hear me? I can't hear myself at all.
Yeah, I'm afraid I can. Yeah,
yeah, I'm afraid I can as well.
I must have pulled the headphones out in all the excitement. I'm back.
Wonderful. Oh. That is good. Oh. Shall we move on to the next movie?
Swiftly.
Mike, over to you. For the benefit of the listeners who obviously can't see us, Mike has just almost taken out an eye on the microphone.
Yeah, health and safety incident.
Oh, God, you honestly
risk assess this show. You know?
Listeners, you have no idea how tiring making this this podcast is.
Yeah, okay, I'm calming down now. I'm calming down. Okay, because we're talking about a much more gentle.
Something like
that. And shall I go ahead? Yes, or are you going to introduce it, Dan?
No, I'm not going to introduce it at all. Over to you.
Okay. The film is. It was made in 1985, just 1 year later than the film we just talked about. And it's a film called After Hours.
1 year later or 1 year before?
Before?
Yeah.
Oh. Hmm. I've got that wrong already, haven't I?
This is going to be good.
Anyway, it's directed.
It stars Jeff Goldblum. It was directed by Orson Welles. And
I'll pay money to say that.
And it's got the guy from Ray Charles and you know,
Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. All of them. Yeah. They're all in it. It's brilliant. There's a unicorn in it. Sorry, carry on.
That's how they know he's one of them.
Oh.
I have no idea what that means.
That's a Blade reference. Blade reference?
Blade reference.
Blade Runner reference.
Oh, I saw Blade
Runner. As your unicorn was, surely.
Oh, Blade Runner. Load of old rubbish, that is.
Come on, Mike, talk quick.
Can I do the synopsis?
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, funnily enough, this synopsis, it's a... I've made a generic synopsis because this synopsis fits the film we talked about, Something Wild, and this film, After Hours. Huh. And therefore, listener, that will show you how similar they are in premise, anyway, if not execution. Okay. The uneventful life of an unremarkable businessman suddenly changes when he meets a wild and sexy but apparently disturbed young woman in a coffee shop, which leads to him finding himself trapped in an escalating series of nightmarishly surreal and darkly comic situations. Now, that applies to both films.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, spot on. You know, yeah.
So, you know, tap on the back for me, I think. Yes, well done.
Yeah. You must be very proud.
Anyway, but okay, listener, you probably want more synopsis than that. So this is what happens. This guy meets a girl in a coffee shop. She gives him his phone, her phone number. Anyway, he goes home, she goes her way. And it's close to midnight, he's flicking through a book, and he finds a number that she's given him. Now, he's got a choice to make. He can think, well, it's late, I'm tired, so I've got a busy day tomorrow. End of movie, really. There is no movie. If he just goes to bed and does the right thing, it's coming up at midnight, there's no sensible person will cross town to see the girl who's just happened to chat to in the coffee shop. But he does. And so he gets a cab. He's got $20 on him. He loses the money out the cab window. And that's it, really. That's where it starts unraveling his life, if you like. Mm. And the whole film then is really a series of comic misadventures, which I've already alluded to. But like, there's suicidal women, psychotic artists, oddball thieves. I mean, it's just like a mishmash of stuff happens to him, and all he wants to do is get home, and he's got no more way of getting home. Mm. And things just keep happening, and it gets worse and worse and more nightmarish. But it's a black comedy. It's been described as Kafkaesque. I think that's being a bit too grand. I can't say that word.
Grandiose.
That's the word.
Well, there actually is a direct reference to Kafka in one of the scenes.
Exactly. So. Bit soody, I think. Mm. I don't think it's like as nightmarish as Kafka, but it's certainly in that kind of ballpark. Mm.
I actually think Kafka-esque. You know, okay, it's not as highbrow as Kafka, but it certainly works on another level. You know, it's like a more accessible Kafka, if you like. Mm.
Kafka light.
Yeah, Kafka light, yeah.
Kafka brown.
Yeah, yeah.
The Da Vinci trial.
Low-cal, you know, yeah. No, definitely.
So that's a synopsis. That was okay, wasn't it? It's a synopsis.
That was fine. Mm. Did you say who it was directed by?
Did I not say Martin Scorsese?
No, I thought I interrupted you before you got to that.
Well, it's funny, because in his... Well, I'm getting into... are we talking about, like, if I liked it or not? Or we can... other stuff.
Yes,
first.
Go on. You tell us what you thought of it.
I thought it was good. The first time I've seen it, actually. I missed it in the 80s. I don't know why, really. Because, you know, Martin Scorsese... I would have seen Martin Scorsese films. I think that in itself kind of shows how much it was just abandoned, if you like, at the cinema when it came out. I will read a few things because it was coming on the back of like a string of five films with Robert De Niro. Mm. And coming up to that, he made Raging Bull, which got critical acclaim and commercial, a lot of money. Then he made King of Comedy, which bombed at the box office, but got lots of critical acclaim. Mm. Then he made After Hours. It kind of passed everyone by. It made some money, it didn't bomb, it made some money. It got some good reviews, didn't tank, but it was like, okay, what's he doing then, doing a comedy? And then Cut a Lot of Money with Paul Newman made a shed load of money. Mm. So it's kind of a lost movie in his oeuvre, and it's rather good.
Yeah.
Mm. I don't think it's as good as his best movies by any means. Mm. But it's rather good. If it wasn't Scorsese, then I'd probably up it, in my opinion. Mm. But I think it's a lesser Scorsese.
Oh, see, I'm not sure I agree with that. I think it's up there, personally, with his with his best work. I mean, I've got a real soft spot for this movie. Interestingly, in terms of the background to it, he had been working on The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yes. Mm.
And they were 4 days away from filming. They'd built sets, they'd created costumes. Harvey Keitel had dyed his hair red to play Judas. It was happening. They were 4 days away from shooting, and the studio pulled it. And Scorsese, similar to Jonathan Demme, Scorsese was basically having a bit of an existential crisis. He was just like, I don't know if I can do this anymore. He, you know, the studios drove him crazy. And he just thought, I don't know if I want to make movies anymore. I don't know if I want to do this. And so they threw various scripts at him, like Beverly Hills Cop. And what else did they throw
at
him?
Beverly, Martin Scorsese could have directed Beverly Hills Cop.
They handed
him
Hills.
Might have been a good,
They handed him Beverly Hills Cop, and he said, what is it? They said, it's a fish out of water thing. He goes, what do you mean? Well, he's a cop from one area, and he goes to another area, and he said, well, that's Coogan's Bluff.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, yeah. And he said, no, I'm not interested. Okay, what about this one? Witness. He's like, I don't know anything about Amish people. No, I'm not interested in that. And eventually, he got hold of a copy of this script and really loved it. Griffin Dunn, who stars in it, was kind of putting the script around. It wasn't his script, but he kind of had an option.
He produced it.
Yeah. And he was punting it around. And Tim Burton was kind of signed on to do it because Scorsese had passed on it. And then Scorsese decided he wanted to do it. So Griffin Dunn had an awkward conversation with Tim Burton and said, well, you know, we're glad that you're on board, Tim. Turns out Scorsese has said that he would quite like to do this, but you're on board now, you're here, so we wouldn't dream of throwing you off. And Tim Burton actually said, yeah, I'm not ever in my life going to try and stop Scorsese from making this script. I'm out. He can have it. I think he will do a fantastic job. And then Scorsese did it. And apparently, at the end of shooting this, it gave Scorsese the kind of shot in the arm that he needed. It gave him his love for film back that had been kind of vampirically sucked from him through the whole Last Temptation of Christ thing. So for Scorsese, I think this is a fairly pivotal film. If it hadn't been for this, I don't know what Scorsese might have gone on to do.
I would argue it's not pivotal. I would argue it's one of his lesser works.
But
Scorsese is 10 times better than most other people's. But best. So
true.
There you go.
But this the key thing is he enjoyed the experience, and you know, it got him enthusiastic again about making films.
Yeah.
You know, a bit like Jonathan Demme. In something more.
No, I mean, it's another excellent 2 films we selected. Many links between them.
Absolutely. This only had a budget of $3.5 million, and he had a 40-day shooting schedule. So they made this film in about 40 days. I think they went over schedule slightly and over budget. But this was effectively a small independent movie.
And apparently, Scorsese, Griffin Dunn, he's a guy out of American Werewolf, if you don't know who he is. Apparently, Scorsese forbade him to have sex.
Yeah, or sleep.
To give him that kind of bewildered look for the movie.
The kind of look that you seem to have, Mike.
Yeah, it's very similar.
I think my wife has done a similar thing. There you go.
I'm going to hand over to Kirk now, and because I would love to hear what your view. You know what? Actually, should we have some music before we hand over to Kirk?
Let's give you
a moment to get your thoughts together, and let's have some wonderful music chosen by our music maestro.
Well, actually, there's two. Well, it's quite a good set. It's not as good as Something Wild soundtrack, but it's pretty good actually. And the best song in it, and it's a pivotal moment. He plays a song on the jukebox. In a bar, and it's one of the best songs ever made in the history of the world. And it's Is That All There Is by Peg Lee.
Marvellous. Let's have a
listen
to that now.
I remember when I was a little girl, our house caught on fire. I'll never forget the look on my father's face as he gathered me up in his arms and raced to the burning building out on the pavement. And I stood there shivering in my pajamas and watched the whole world go up in flames. And when it was all over, I said to myself, is that all there is to a fire? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all there is. And when I was 12 years old, my daddy took me to the circus, the greatest show on earth. There were clowns and elephants and dancing bears, and a beautiful lady in pink tights flew high above our heads. And as I sat there watching, I had the feeling that something was missing. I don't know what, but when it was all over, I said to myself, is that all there is to the circus? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all there is. And then I fell in love with the most wonderful boy in the world. We'd take long walks down by the river, or just sit for hours gazing into each other's eyes. We were so very much in love. And then one day, he went away, and I thought I'd die, but I didn't. And when I didn't, I said to myself, is that all there is to love? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep. I know what you must be saying to yourselves. If that's the way she feels about it, why doesn't she just end it all? Oh no, not me.
Oh wow!
I love that.
It's brilliant, actually.
So, right, Kirk, over to you. What do you think? What do you think of this?
Well, I saw this at the cinema as well. Funny enough, back in about 1986, something like that. Like a little time after it was released, and it was like one of these typical late night features at the Classic in Westcliff, if any local people remember the Classic, very well known for its late night films. and it was one of those ones that I just stumbled across. You know, it was like a late night coming back from the Grand, and they'd always have films on, like, as you stumbled back from the Grand, you know, walking back to Westcliff, and just went in there in a drunken stupor. And it, you actually felt part of the film when you were watching it. And all those memories came flooding back, actually, because I probably hadn't, again, I hadn't seen it for probably about 20 years, roughly. It all came flooding back. There were lots of little moments that were absolute gems, and there's some great acting in it. I mean, Terry Garr, I absolutely adored Terry Garr. I mean, she's fantastic, and definitely deserves a mention. Rosanna Arquette, I don't think we've even mentioned her name.
No.
Absolutely fabulous. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought her role was really good. And considering it was on the back of the film she'd just done with Madonna, I've forgotten the name of it now. Who's that girl, was it? Or
Desiree Seek and Susan.
But where she plays quite a quirky sort of character, you kind of think she's going to be like that in this film, but she's actually a very different sort of character. And her acting ability really comes across well on the screen. Yeah. So I really had fun watching this, I have to say. It was beautifully shot. I mean, again, I don't think we've given it much background as to where the location was, but it was in downtown Soho in Manhattan. Mm. Again, there's a little link there between the two films because they both start off in New York. And it was all filmed at night. Mm. Beautiful, just really atmospheric, and it's really run down bits of New York. You know, it's really just squalor everywhere, you know. And I just thought it was brilliant. I just really thought it was good. I completely forgot about Cheech and Chong in there, you know,
yes,
who weren't being Cheech and Chong. They were being different characters, albeit they were in it together, you know, as a pair. And, you know, the whole background of there's a thief going around, or the thieves going around, you know, lifting things from apartment blocks around this part of Manhattan, and everyone gets together, and you know, they kind of like the big community get together and try and find out what's going on, you know. No, I honestly think I actually preferred this to After Hours, funny enough, even
to
though
something
I was
wild, you mean?
Sorry, to Something Wild. I'm getting really confused there. Yeah. So yeah, I think I really did enjoy this film more so. And I was really surprised how much I did. I thought Griffin Dunne, I thought absolutely brilliant, and I don't know why he didn't make more films, because he's such a good comedic dark actor. I just thought, yeah. Great.
Well, he moved into directing, didn't he?
Yeah.
Largely. But yeah, no, I know what you mean. He's that's a fantastic job in this. Really carries the carries the whole film.
Yeah, brilliant.
I think one of my favourite lines in this movie is a bit because of all these things that are going horribly wrong, and eventually he's got most of the community. You know, basically, it should be pointed out, the main point of this film is, all he wants is to go out and meet someone.
Yeah.
And he ends up in this Kafka-esque type nightmare where he can't get home. Mm. His money flies out of the window of a taxi. He manages to get $20. Mm. He finally manages to get it. A taxi pulls up and it's the same taxi driver. And he says, look, I've got the $20. And the taxi driver goes, brilliant, snatches it off him and screams away in his car. So he's still stuck. He goes down to the subway to try and get a train home, and the guy sitting there at the booth says, sorry, the fares went up at midnight, it's $1.50. And he's like, I haven't got it. Well, you can't get on the train then. He's trapped, he can't get home, and you've got these people, gradually you've got the entire community who are out looking for him with flashlights and virtually sort of like flaming torches and pitchforks, because they think he's the thief, the one that's been going around robbing people. And there's a wonderful line in it where he's hiding on a fire escape and he's drenched in sweat and rain because it's raining for most of the movie, and he's just crouching on this fire escape, and he looks across the alleyway and there's an apartment across the way where a husband and wife are having an argument. And the wife suddenly pulls out a gun and shoots the husband 4 times in the chest, and he slumps to the floor. And it goes back to Griffin Dunne, and he just says to himself, yeah, I'll probably get blamed for that. Just kind of carries on. It's wonderful, and it is completely nightmarish. He simply can't get home.
Yeah.
Wonderful movie.
I've got a little bit of trivia that I really must mention, because I know Scorsese, when he actually filmed it all and put it together, he didn't know how to end the film, and I'm not going to mention how the film ends, because I think that's a bit of a spoiler, and I know it's an old film, but I think if you really want to enjoy this film, it's best not to know what happens. But he was really debating what to do, and he spoke to some of his peers, like Brian De Palma and a few other directors that he knew well. And finally, it was Michael Powell who suggested the ending of the film. And for those that don't know who Michael Powell is, the man who directed The Red Shoes and, I'm trying to think of other films.
Matter of Life and Death.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And he suggested the ending. So I thought that was intriguing, that someone that Scorsese really looked up to, I mean, and I know The Red Shoes is one of his all-time favourite films, he actually took advice from this amazing peer that he admired, you know.
And it is a really great ending as well, isn't it?
I think
it's not a huge, epic ending. It's quite downplayed and quite unconventional and fortuitous, but still really works very well.
Yeah. I don't like the ending.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I really didn't like the ending. So I liked the film. I thought the ending was... it was unsatisfying.
You would have preferred one of the endings that Scorsese was working on, which is that Griffin Dunne's character, Paul Hackett, he meets up at the end with that character, June, who's sitting there in the when that particular song we just listened to was playing.
Yeah.
And one of the endings Scorsese came up with was of the character of June saying, quickly, get in. And you have this bizarre scenario where he crawls inside her and she walks out, and then later she effectively gives birth to him on the streets near where he lives, and he's given birth to naked on the streets of Manhattan, and then runs home, which would have been completely bizarre and surreal, and I think would have potentially ruined the film. You would have liked that, wouldn't you? You would have loved it.
Yeah.
No, I think that would be just nuts. But
good Lord, if Mike says it's nuts, then...
But actually, though, you're talking about Kafka-esque, and I downplayed that, but you upped it. So you it was like if Kafka had ended metamorphosis when he'd woke up and thought, oh, good, I'm not a beetle after all. It's all a dream. He's like, it kind of devalues everything that's gone before.
I kind of think it's an appropriate ending, personally, because the whole film is about him being entirely out of control. He has no control over what's happening, and he's caught up in this nightmare, and then eventually he's whisked away from it and pretty much dropped back into his life. Very much changed.
Very much, yeah.
I thought it was probably the best ending that they could have had.
I didn't know that I had problems finding the ending, and Steven Spielberg is another one, drafted it in to try to work out how to end it. And I think it shows they didn't know how to end the film, personally. If Scorsese had come to me, I could have told him.
So, After Hours, I'm going to come to a few little links here between the two. First of all, I will say there is a DVD available of After Hours. It's not cheap. It's about £14. There's no Blu-ray anywhere in the world. It's never been released on Blu-ray. And I'm astonished that somebody like Criterion haven't picked this up, because I think it's an absolute gem.
Yeah.
But it is available on Blu-ray quite easily. So
DVD.
But a DVD, yes. Yeah, thank you for correcting me, because I'm an idiot. I do apologise. So a couple of little links. Something Wild. E. Max Fry, who wrote the script, he wrote it when he was still in film school, and it was the first script of his that ever got made. Joseph Minion, who wrote After Hours, he wrote it while he was still in film school, and it was the first script that he ever had made.
That's amazing.
Also, something which you touched upon a little bit, Mike, when you gave your kind of... let's not go there. Which, when you gave your synopsis of that effectively covered both films. In both films, the main characters meet in a diner whilst one of them is reading a book. In After Hours, Griffin Dunne's character is reading Tropic of Cancer by Henry Miller. And in Something Wild, Melanie Griffith's, Griffith's character is reading a biography of the Mexican artist Frida Kahlo, which I thought was quite nice. And the final thing is Scorsese directed After Hours. He also, of course, directed Goodfellas. And Ray Liotta was cast in Goodfellas as Henry Hill explicitly because Scorsese loved his performance in Something Wild.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Brilliant. Yeah. He saw the performance and thought, this is the guy.
Wow.
So Brilliant. That's fantastic. Pretty nice. That's a nice link. There we go. Are we at the end?
I think we are.
I think we probably are. I think we are. Are we having a little bit of music? A little burst of music to play us out. Yes.
While
you're looking at your notes, I will say goodbye.
And goodbye from me as well.
Goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
And what are we playing out on?
It's a scene in the film where he goes into a punk club and they try to give him a mohawk. And it's by a band called Bad Brains, and it's called Pay to Come.
Marvellous. See you in a month.
See ya.
See ya.
Bye.
Just a mind, we will still walk by, we'll step behind.